So, according to the transgender ideology, what's the difference between gender and sex? Someone give it a shot?
Gender is a choice, sex isn't.
Okay, so they say, okay, that's kind of part of it. There's a little bit more to it.
Soul and body.
Yeah, there's kind of like a soul and body distinction, okay? And so they would say that sex is your biological...
The equipment you were born with,
right? Sex assigned at birth is often what they say. Where the gender is who you conceptualize yourself to be. So if you have a correspondence where you conceptualize yourself as a male and you have the sex as a male, you are cisgendered, right? So everything's in harmony. But there are people, according to this ideology, where their gender is out of alignment with their sex. So they conceptualize themselves to be a female, but they are biologically male, and that produces something they call gender dysphoria, okay? And so when you have gender dysphoria, the solution is to do what, usually? What's the traditional course of action?
Right now or like back in the day?
Right now they do, yeah.
Surgery.
It'd be surgery, right? You try to conform your sex to match your gender, okay? Now within this, I mean, there's all kinds of like gender fluid. There's LGBT, and then there's like a multitude of letters after that, which is kind of difficult to kind of keep up. But that's kind of the main concept that we find. And so, and because of modern technology, right? Like 100 years ago, there's no way you could do this. And really, I'm just going to call it what it is. It's bodily mutilation. You can never, you know, the biological reality is every cell in your body has DNA that is sex specific, right? So you can never actually change that, but it's really a cosmetic surgery, bodily mutilation, because the whole point is not to change the function of the organ so that they work well, but to create a cosmetic appearance of an organ that's not necessarily there. And then you, so you go to the Mayo Clinic about, you know, sex change operations, or they call them gender confirmation surgeries. They talk about the benefits are all psychological in nature. But then the side effects are biological in nature, which is really interesting. Okay? So that's kind of the framework that we are working with. So when you, one of the things that we talked about last week is that when God created man, he created them male and female, body and soul. And when you look at scripture, there's kind of a hazy line between the body and the soul, right? Like David in Psalm 32 talks about how, you know, when he was in unrepentant sin, his body was wasting away, right? A joyful heart is good medicine. I'd even say there's connections between the brain, right, and how we live. Like if somebody looks at porn continually, that actually rewires their brain, right? There's a relationship between the body and the soul, which is why death is so terrible, because the soul is rent from the body. But in a future resurrection, the body and soul will be joined together. Now, one thing why this is really important is if you look at, in Greek thought at the time, and this is something the disciples would often push back on, especially the Apostle Paul, they would see that the material, the body, is inherently evil, right? It's something of the earth, something that needs to be taken away from. You know, your spirit has to kind of be detached. Some Buddhist thought might actually have that same type of concept, right? That who you really are is just the soul. Your body has nothing to do with you. Does that make sense?
It has to be overcome.
It has to be overcome. Okay, so that's kind of the framework. But then you also get into this concept of, you know, just gender, that you have different callings for each gender, right? To be fruitful and multiply. And what's interesting is when you look at the curse, okay, what's the curse on the woman?
Childbirth.
It's childbirth, right? Specific to childbirth. And the curse on the man is specific to?
Swine.
Yeah. So the woman's ability to nurture life is cursed, and the man's strength, you know, to overcome the earth is cursed. So even within the be fruitful and multiply, there's different callings depending on what your gender is. And there's a lot of things that we can obviously all do, right? But a man can never produce a child, right? A man can never nurture life. A man can never breastfeed, right? So all of those things that make a woman, are unique to her calling. Okay, so that's all the background. And there is so I'll give you this note on the top of page 8. You know, each person is made in the image of God, and as image bearers, we have been created body and soul. Further, God designed our physical bodies to fulfill a purpose. The presence or absence of a Y chromosome determines our destinies. Should you get married, your body determines whether you will be a husband and wife. If you have children, your body determines whether or not you'll be a mother or father. So understanding, this understanding helps us frame the rest of the biblical teaching about gender. Okay? So any questions about that? So there is man, there is woman, both made in the image of God, both equally valuable, but they have different roles, and their bodies are key to fulfilling those roles. Yeah.
I think it's an interesting thought because, say, you know, there's the if you try and address the transgender kind of viewpoint without that belief we talked about last week, that, you know, if gender is something, like they know that they're born with a certain physical body,
mm-hmm.
and they've identify as a different gender. The question is, they know that they have the body of a woman, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that they think of when they define gender? Like, we know that your body determines these things about your
mm-hmm.
life. And so, for a person that's you know, arguing for transgenderism, there has to be something other than the body, because they don't contest, yes, you have this particular body. So what is it that...
Yeah.
No, what else is there to being a man than having
yeah.
a man's body? Right?
Yeah.
For them, there's a vacuum in that question. What is there to being a woman that's not related to your body? And so where the Bible, you know, we address that, there's kind of this vacuum where it's like they understand that your body does, but where do they draw from that?
Yeah, and it kind of implies that there is there's some conception, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a concept of what makes one gender of a man or woman. If it's not biologically defined, then they define it by gender, and they still approve of the pronouns, right? I mean, they'll just kind of switch it, right? Instead of being a him, it's a her. So there is a concept of gender, but, you know, part of the progression is even just doing away with all pronouns in general, right? That there really shouldn't even be a masculinity and femininity. There's just no role distinction. So that's kind of, so when you keep on adding letters to the LGBT, you're getting, I don't know if there's pangender. I mean, there's just, it keeps on expanding. But even traditional transgenderism, as we see it, it's, there still is a concept of what makes somebody a man. And how do you even know that, right? How do you even define that in a postmodern society? So you look at this, part of the argument that we're going to make is that there is an inherent goodness in creation. Okay, so granted, there is a fall, and the fall does account for some wrongness, right? But when you look at when Adam and Eve, before the fall, they were gendered individuals. You know, they had two complementary sexes before the fall. That division was not a result of the fall. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not a disease or anything like that, okay? And that does affirm the goodness of creation. So that's why we can make an argument from, I would say, nature, because nature as it was created was good. It was right for there to be a man and a woman. And so understanding the goodness of that, the affirmation of that, I think can help us to frame Deuteronomy 22:5. Somebody want to read that?
A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God.
Okay. So, what does this passage prohibit?
Dressing as the opposite sex,
okay? So, on the surface, right, this seems like a slam dunk passage, right? But what would be some problems using this in, let's say, a debate with a transgendered or pro-transgender friend? What are the limitations of using this passage? What do you think, Noah? Yeah, so this is for Israel. It was an old covenant command, right? And so, a lot of times I'll throw in that this was maybe a cultic religious practice, which it could be. So there's a lot we don't know about this, but I think when you understand it, I think the basic point, the basic spirit shows that men should be men and women should be women. That was something affirmed in the Old Covenant law. Now, if you're to look at the New Testament, I think there's a passage that teaches the same thing and is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is one of those infamous passages because it talks about head coverings, right? And do women need to wear head coverings? And I don't see any women wearing head coverings right now, so it can be real easy to point out that we don't perfectly apply this passage. And obviously, there's a lot of the culture at the time that kind of contours the whole thing. The Corinthian church was a kind of a dysfunctional church. There was a lot of affluence, a lot of sexual morality, a lot of compromise there. There was, I think, an early form of feminism that you have there, where a lot of women were kind of rejecting marriage and being under marriage. And that was actually a very common thought. A lot of women would kind of go to what's called realized eschatology, that the resurrection has already happened. Therefore, we take Jesus' teaching that there's no marriage in heaven. We're like the angels. And they say, well, I'm done with this relationship, right? And so Paul does a lot to kind of dial that back and to try to reorder a proper understanding of marriage, and even a proper understanding of what it means to be a man and a woman. And so he affirms the gender roles in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Somebody want to read that passage 1 through 3? Okay, so we got three relationships here, right? What are they?
Head of every man is Christ.
Okay, so we have, right, we have Christ kind of over man, right? What else?
Man over woman.
Okay, man over woman.
Husband and wife.
Yeah.
Okay. That's probably more specific, right? Okay, and what else?
God over Christ.
Yeah, God over Christ. And if you were kind of like synthesize all these, right, you would have, according to this passage, right, God, then Christ, then man, and then woman. Okay? So, I mean, this is talking about roles and leadership. Would we say, I mean, you look at God would be over Christ, but Christ also exalts God, right? Christ is over man, but man exalts Christ. And yet, even Christ exalts man to a certain extent, right, by giving him his righteousness. But this is just kind of the hierarchical order presented in that passage, okay? So that's kind of the building block of his, of the argument that he's going to be making. So verse 4 through 6. This is, or verse 4 through 7. Somebody want to read that?
Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered. uncovered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. Mm-hmm. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man.
So, a lot of debate about what is this head covering. Obviously, it would be a shawl that would cover the head, but what it means is a subject of debate. My best guess was, we know from the passage that the shawl is somehow representative of authority, and it is also something that is unique to a woman in the fashion sense, not necessarily the man. Does that make sense? So, as far as the modern application of this, I mean, it's just kind of hard to say. But what we do know is that it was something that the woman wore, the man did not, and was distinct to the woman, and that it was a symbol of authority. Okay, any questions about that? That's the safe ground.
How was it a symbol of authority?
They're under... My guess would be... there was something about it that kind of signaled that I'm a woman. As opposed to...
Like a girl, right?
Okay. Like we have... there's women's fashions and men's fashions. Right? There's a men's section and a women's section. We're going to say something, Becky?
Yes, there's also... I mean, we know from a lot of places in Scripture that during that time there were a number of different ways that when a girl would hit a certain age, she would have to start wearing some kind of covering on her head. That was just kind of throughout the ancient Near East.
Yeah.
And then when a woman would be married, there would be a different covering that she would wear.
Mm-hmm.
A different degree of covering or something, so that you could immediately, in looking at a girl, know if it was a maiden or a wife. So that's probably related here.
Yeah.
That everyone wore something from the time you were, you know, a girl of 8 or whatever on.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe 12, maybe it was when you were eligible. It just depended on where you were.
Yeah.
So for a girl to have her hair covered was almost a universal, just for a female in general,
mm-hmm.
to have something on her head. It was almost universal, and it showed something about her marital state or whatever.
Yeah.
In most places.
So there's something unique to the culture at that time. I mean, it's kind of like we have women who, they wear the engagement ring, the man doesn't. So it would be distinct. If you see a man walking around with a diamond ring, I mean... you come to some obvious conclusions, right?
I don't know what obvious conclusions.
Well,
we would
like
his
boyfriend proposed. Yeah,
it
is a wondering.
A girl's wearing that, you know what to conclude.
Yeah.
But that's not across cultures either.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this for some reason, in this culture, they knew what that meant.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So, if a woman took off her head covering, who would she look like, according to this passage? She'd look like a man, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what does Paul link? Okay, we talked that. So, similarly, if a man wore a head covering, who would he look like?
A woman.
Look like a woman, right? So that's, so even though we don't know the exact cultural import, we know enough from this passage that Paul is saying that men should look like men, and women should look like women. Okay, and that's, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, right? And other children of the 80s here. Okay, so during the 80s, you had glam metal. Right? You guys know what glam metal is? Like Motley Crue, Poison. And how did they dress?
They put on makeup.
They looked like women. And what was interesting is if, you know, if they were to walk into a bar dressed like that, the people who were in their concert halls cheering them on would beat them up. But because they were on stage, somehow that was acceptable. And I think, you know, one of the things that made that rock really edgy, right, was kind of blurring the cultural boundaries between male and female. I mean, if you kind of go even back to, let's say, David Bowie, he kind of pioneered that. Or where, and so there was kind of like this edginess, kind of violating this norm that made it appealing and rebellious, right? So that's why the glam metal guys dressed up like women. And so there's kind of an inherent rebellion there, and I think that's why a lot of young people are kind of drawn to that. So, I mean, what do verses 6 and 7 point out about Paul's regard for androgyny? Yeah, so you look at, let's say, your stereotypical lesbian couple, right? Often one will take on the masculine role by shaving their head, right? And kind of looking that way. Even men who are homosexuals, they often put on more flamboyant, feminine-looking dress, right? And so there is kind of a, you know, that kind of androgyny is something that can be, well, I think forbidden because it's a rejection of the gender roles as God made them. Okay? So, verse 8. Someone want to read that?
For man is not made for woman, but woman for man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God.
Okay. So what rationale does Paul provide for this command? What's the basis? What do you think, Noah? Mm-hmm. Okay, and you bring created, right? So he makes a clear reference to creation, right? For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for the woman, but the woman for man, right? So the woman was created to be a helper suitable for him. And so he's saying that this symbol of authority and expressing it is not something that's post-fall, it's something that's pre-fall. That there's a goodness in the way that this should be expressed. Now, just so you know, he also talks about how, yeah, the man is dependent on the woman because he needs a woman to bring life to him. So he does talk about, even though they're complementary in roles and one leads to the other, he does affirm, you know, the equal value of both, right? So there's kind of a line there. But does this passage accept the notion that gender is fluid and not binary? Why not? What do you think, Noah?
It's not like you don't have to choose. There's not options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just kind of like, you can do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's interesting is that, for as a woman was made from a man, so then now man is born of a woman. Right? There's no, he was born of a woman, then decided to become a woman. Right? The man category that he's talking about here, what he was assigned from birth, is what continues to the end. Does that make sense? There's no switching. He doesn't see a difference between gender and sex. So based off this passage, why does God want differences expressed? Why is that important?
Well, if the basic godly or biblical principle doesn't stay in place, you have chaos. There's not order.
There's not order, right?
Yeah, this passage is talking about order. I mean, you have up there all these different orders mm-hmm. that he's established. And so, basically, how you dress is signaling that you accept your place in that order.
Yeah. Does that make sense? How you dress signals that you express your place in that order. And I would just say, you know, that's why cross-dressing or even the gland metal. I remember talking to a young man who had two large earrings here. And I asked him why he did it. He said, well, because it looks cool. Well, why does it look cool? Because it's edgy. Well, what makes it edgy? It's because it challenges this order.
And they were very feminine earrings.
And they were very feminine earrings, yeah. I kept on referring them to them as ladies' earrings. So why are you wearing ladies' earrings, right? And that's why, let's say, wearing one earring is a little bit different, because women don't necessarily do that. Does that make sense? I'm not an earring guy. I'm not a tattoo guy either, right? But, you know, to each his own, that's just where I am. But yeah, that's why androgyny is wrong. It's basically a rejection of the order that God has. It's defying it, right? It's like taking it to the man. I mean, rebellion is cool. You know, that's kind of what makes it attractive. So, and I know some men here, it's not here, does wear earrings, but there's a difference between feminine earrings and male earrings. You know what I'm saying? So you want to keep the, you know, keep it separated. Okay,
I mean,
any questions?
I think that's the thing, is we don't understand exactly what he was talking about here, but each culture does have its own understood symbols and signals of what is male and what's female.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if you're, you know, in the jungle in South America, it's going to be different, but they still know what it is.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you look at birds, the male robin and the female robin. I mean, it's just, it's everywhere. And conceivably, I mean, there might be a totalitarian culture where they try to get men and women to dress the same. I think China tried that for a while. It didn't really work out. But there is a, and that's why we should, you know, push back on androgyny. Because it tries to blur the line, and basically it's a rejection of the created order. Okay, so that's kind of my New Testament argument. I think it's making that Old Testament argument as well. So moving on, here's another one. So we have Ephesians 5, 22 through 25. Kind of building on this. Somebody want to read that?
Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head, the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. And as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her.
Okay. So what roles are assigned to the husbands and which ones are assigned to the wives?
The head of the wife.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, what are some actions that each is supposed to do?
Wives are to submit and husbands are to love the wife.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the other thing is, you know, what's the greater purpose of all this too? Yeah. And so the whole thing works when Christ and the church are two clearly separate entities, right? And each of these entities has a distinct responsibility and role, where the Christ is not supposed to submit to the church. If Christ were to submit to the church, that would give you a bad theology of Christ, right? And so this is kind of like a living communion meditation, where marriage, as it's designed, is supposed to picture that complementary role of loving leadership and joyful submission, of the offer of the gospel, the acceptance of the gospel. Okay, and that only works when you keep those two roles defined. So, does Paul seem to allow for individuals to choose which commands they heed? Why is this significant to the transgender discussion? Can you choose which command you heed? What do you think, Scott?
Well, I was thinking a couple of things. You know, part of it is, you know, there's a lot of passages addressing men and wives, and we're talking more the difference between men and women. And so one thought I had was that it's interesting that many times the word it's the same word in the original, like wife, woman,
mm-hmm.
like it can be translated.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at a passage, and sometimes it says husbands and wife, it's that same word for wife is woman. So there's
mm-hmm.
like not a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, I think someone might argue, well, that's for the husband, but I'm going to be the husband, even though I'm not the man.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? So like, mm-hmm. it's still, it's like a new belief that, well, this is addressing husbands and wives, but maybe the husband is going to be a woman and the wife is going to be a man. You know, like
mm-hmm.
they're trying to switch. And so it's bringing,
yeah.
We talked about with, and how to interpret the Bible, it's bringing modern meanings
yeah.
to the words that didn't exist
yeah.
at the time. So in order to, you know, kind of interact with that, you would have to create this
mm-hmm.
very recent view of men and women and
yeah.
put it back onto them.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Greek language, there's, you know, three cases. The, not cases, there's, you have the neuter case, feminine, and masculine, right? Spanish the same way, German's the same way. I don't know about other languages, but it's very, you know, it's separating the genders and making sure that when you use a pronoun, you have he versus she is a normal convention of language where it's kind of built into our cultural DNA. But one thing is, you know, who you are born with, I mean, in the sovereignty of God, that's what you are. You know, that's what you are. Now, people are talking about intersex. We'll address that a little bit later on, and there's a good argument for that. But yeah, we don't really choose what gender we are. Right? We don't choose what roles we apply. And clearly, there's two separate commands depending on your sex/gender. So another one, 1 Corinthians 6:9. Who wants to read that?
Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals.
Okay, so here's the note. The effeminate and homosexuals represent the passive and active participants in same-sex activity. Both the one who acts like the female and the one who treats the male as a female are at fault. So how does God's condemnation of the active and passive participants in homosexual acts help us to understand God's sentiment towards transgenderism?
Well, it kind of seems like transgenderism is a step farther than homosexuality, which it clearly condemns. So.
Okay. Anybody else want to venture in on this one? Everyone's afraid to talk about this one, right? Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is a man acting like a woman in bed. Right? That is the condemnation. That's why it's effeminate. So it's the active and the passive recipient. That's why they're sister sins, really. While this speaks of same-sex activity and not cross-dressing, it helps us to understand God's moral objection to homosexuality. Let me make a little editing note here. By refusing to embrace the complementary roles of husband and wife, they have rejected the created order. This is part of the reason why transgenderism is a sister sin to homosexuality. Both reject a creative order. Homosexuality rejects the complementary nature of the husband and wife relationship, and transgenderism disavows God's prerogative in making humans male and female. And so here's another one, Leviticus 12, 1 through 3. Somebody want to read this? Some brave male or female? Noah, go ahead. You looked at me.
The woman spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, as at the time of her menstruation she shall be unclean. And on the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall you circumcise.
Okay. Now this is I picked this one for a reason, right? You clearly have male and female specific commands in this passage, right? Is it possible for a male who identifies as a female to obey the commands of verse 2? Why not?
He's never
going to
go through that.
He's never going to go through that. It's an impossibility, right? Is it possible for a female who identifies as a male to obey the command of verse 3? Not at all, right? It's not possible.
Yeah.
So there is no... To make this gender sex distinction, I mean, this is an artificial construct.
Yeah. And I think it's funny because, like, if you reverse the order that I've seen the transgender say, you know, oh, yeah, a man could fulfill that command, because if you go the other way, if it's a female who identifies as a male, right, then this woman is giving birth, but they'd say, well, that's a man that's fulfilling that, like a transgender man.
Yeah.
And, I read an article about this man was fighting for his right to have maternity leave because he was getting ready to have a baby and all this stuff, and the author just kept talking about this man that's going to have his baby. And so it's so, like, reversed in the perspective that they think that, well, yeah, you can have a man that bears a child because like you said, they're doing the gender. As the, like, what's inside their mind is that's what's the reality.
Yeah, and you look at the uphill, I mean, totally normalizing. Every cell in their body has DNA that points a certain direction. All of our language, and even past languages, have very clear indications of gender. Every month, a woman has a reminder of her gender and sex, right? It, you know, separating those two is just an impossibility. And all of it is because, you know, they feel like their concept of gender is out of alignment. And, I mean, one thing I mean, a lot of people just feel different. A lot of people feel uncomfortable in their bodies. Mm. Is a sex change going to be the solution to it? I mean, so it's... I mean, it's a kind of a brave new world, and all of this would not even be a consideration apart from technology. So let's look at Jesus' words, Matthew 19:4. He answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? Who made the males men and females women?" Not a trick question. God did, right? And Jesus echoes that, right?
Jesus,
right? Now, how do these passages answer the objection God made a mistake by putting a man in a female body?
God doesn't make mistakes, but...
Yeah, and this is actually a trick question. God put a square in a circle. Right? It's like, no,
there's no such thing as a man and a female body.
Yeah, there's no such thing.
Body.
This is an artificial construct. It's an artificial construct.
Whenever you have that conversation, it doesn't exist.
As soon as you try to answer that question and you take that question at face value, you've already conceded about 90% of the argument, right? God made a mistake by putting a man in a female body. No, he did not, because that's an artificial construct.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the conversation that people have is they throw around lots of examples that don't exist. Mm-hmm. What about people who are born both? You know, like
and that is different, because that actually is a biological argument. Okay, so if you say, okay, stop right there. Let's talk about biology.
Body issue.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about that cell issue, that's body issue. We'll go ahead and talk about that. Now, if you're going to base your argument off of that, What about a person over here where that's not the case and every cell in their body has a Y chromosome? I mean, if you're going to talk about biology and make it a biological argument, that's losing ground for this construct. It doesn't hold water.
How many people are actually born that way?
Yeah, it's enough.
It's like 1% who have some.
Yeah.
No, but there's no one who's born fully male and fully female in the sense that they can impregnate themselves.
True.
That's,
I've never got that.
That's upset.
You know what I'm saying?
There is no person who is genetically both.
But that really is a red herring, right? Mm-hmm. It's you're going to point to this biological reality to justify the separation between gender and biology. It doesn't quite work that
way. Right.
Right? So I'd say that's just a completely different issue. And where the biology is warped and everything, that's a clear sign of the fall. But when we're talking about somebody who is completely biologically normal in that regard, and they're saying that this is out of alignment, that's a different issue. Okay, so don't. So I would say being a male born and a female, I mean, that's a trap. Mm-hmm. Are you going to say something? No.
I mean, because they would not just say God made a mistake. What they would say is that the gender not matching the sex is a factor of the fall.
Yeah.
That just like, you know, a person who's born in between or whatever, they would put those in the same theological category, and we would too, but we would say that the fall is located
in the heart.
Their heart.
Yeah.
In the case of somebody whose gender doesn't match their sex, because the sex is clear. That is God made. That is not broken.
Yeah.
In 99% of people.
Yeah.
But what is broken in 100% of us is our heart, and in some people that expresses itself through not enjoying our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's the issue, is you can't concede that bifurcation. And as long as you don't concede that, then the argument stays on appropriate theological grounds.
Yeah. Yeah, the issue is not the body. The issue is the heart. Especially when it's a healthy body, right? If it's an unhealthy body, that's kind of, when we talk about the fall, that's what we're talking about. Those things about us that lead to our death and the proper, well, the non-function, you know, of our bodies. Okay? And then, but here's another one. Psalm 139:13. For you are formed in my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. So according to this passage, who determines the sex? Post-fall. Yeah, God does, right? Now, some people will raise the objection, sex is not as apparent as you may think. For instance, some people are born intersex. They are both have male and female genitalia. Now, this is a rare condition, and normally it is obvious which set of genitalia is functional and which one isn't. So why do we have intersex individuals? Or why do we have conjoined twins? It'd be
the fall,
right? So why is it problematic for transgenders to appeal to the biological reality of intersex individuals? Yeah, you're the ones rejecting biology, right?
They just want to justify their sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Biology points a certain direction. So what's the problem with someone whose chromosomes say male and genitalia say male, but his, quote, brain says female? What would be the biological conclusion in that case? Scott, all the religion. Yeah, he's a male, right? Yeah, so that's why the biology argument, it just doesn't work. So a theological argument, humans are made in the image of God. For God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him. And the image of God includes a body and soul. And I would include Adam became Adam. I need to edit this one. Became Adam when he breathed life into him, right? That's when he truly became a human being at that point. So putting it all together,
We see the Bible does not recognize the distinction between gender and sex. Its emphasis on gender roles and gender-specific commands reveals that people do not pick and choose which set of laws to obey. Further, some of the commands are anatomically specific. Therefore, we see that God does not recognize the distinction between sex and gender, and our sovereign God is the one who assigns our sex. The expression of our sex in our wardrobe, as well as our obedience to gender-specific commands, affirms God's designs for male and female. Further, such expression is true. When one claims to be a male, they are not biologically, they'll tell a lie. It would be akin to a white woman darkening her skin, dyeing and curling her hair, and claiming to be black. She may be well-intentioned. She may want to be black. She may not feel like she's white, but that does not change the reality. In the same way, a man may want to be a woman, but he will never be able to carry a child. He'll never experience the pain of menstruation. He will never be able to conceive with a male. God calls us to tell the truth and embrace the truth. The construct which denies truth as truth is not from God. So given the sinfulness of transgenderism, how do we minister to those caught in a snare? And we will kind of pause right there. But yeah, any questions about this? Again, this is a harder proof than homosexuality because you have very clear verses that speak against it. But this is a case where you have a modern construct being imposed on the Bible, and you have to demonstrate why the modern construct is deeply flawed. And so that's why with transgenderism it's helpful to kind of know some of the worldview behind it. Okay?
The Bible does talk a little bit about eunuchs. I think aren't involved in sacrificing.
Yeah, they're not allowed to be a part of the temple.
Yeah.
And basically that's a prohibition against making eunuchs. You know what I'm saying? It's not something that you are to do. Thank the Lord, right? But yeah, it was very common practice back in those days to make men eunuchs so that they can work with women and work on the queen's court. So I'd say that's
something that was done to them. They weren't born there.
Yeah, something done to them. And some of them might have chosen it for career opportunities. Who knows? All right, well, let me pray, and then I'll let you guys go. Well, Father, I do thank you for just the teaching of Scripture, and I pray that all of us will walk away with a firm conviction that there is a goodness in creation being made male and female. And I pray that you'll give us a lot of wisdom in just talking and ministering to people who struggle with this reality. Pray for our next period of worship that'll be one that will just be exciting as we gather with your people, sing praises to you, and listen to your word. In Christ's name, amen.